On this week's show, discussing artful use of technology with Jackson Hoggard and Mark Sanderson.
Construction is the world's oldest industry but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back. A special episode of the ConTech Crew. That's right, you don't see one of my usually friendly co-hosts. I missed all of you, but I'm in charge and I get to mix it up a little bit. And Jackson and I known each other for a while. He's a contractor that's doing some incredible things at Double Hung. And we had this conversation about this cool software and he showed me it. And he said, we should come on and talk. And I was like, let's do it. So Jackson, how you doing, man?
Doing well, man. Thanks for having me on, Jeff. It's a full circle moment for me. My construction technology journey started with the ConTech Trio back in the day, when I was working for a traditional builder, you know, no technology, just this is the way we've always done. And I was like, there's got to be a better way. And, you know, I think it was like episode 4 or 5 I got plugged into. And yeah, here I am listening to or participating. So thanks for sparking my construction nerd journey.
Oh, that is awesome. It's we've had a couple of those. And so if you're listening, that means you might be the next person on the show out there if you've got something crazy. Because Jackson, you've done a ton and I've learned a lot from you over especially the last few months that we've had time to talk, your journey with the CPC and your, you know, ability to articulate some of the problems we have in the industry, one of which was what brought Mark to us. So Mark, say hello. It's great to have you come along with us.
Hey, Jeff, I really appreciate that. It's good to be here also and chatting with your with your audience. Just give you a little bit of background on energy and who we are. We are an ERP software servicing today the woodworking industry. So if you look at that part of the trade partner realm, that's who we target. But that's just our starting point. We have expansion plans beyond that relative to what we do and how we do it within the construction realm.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that's how we're gonna link this two together. Cause well, Jackson, just as most of our, and this explains a lot now, Jackson, that you started listening to us at episode 4 and 5, that you would not wait for Mark's plan. You're like, Mark, you have a plan, but screw you. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to do it now and we'll figure it out later. So listen, we're going to dive into all of that. But before we dive into all of that, y'all know what's coming. We got to pause for the cause.
Whenever you're talking about something as substantial as suicide awareness and as alarming as to statistics around construction being the second highest rates of suicide in industry, we'd be fooling ourselves if we thought that this was a one-player fix, meaning that it just takes one silver bullet or one easy button to solve this challenge. This is a multi-threaded challenge, if you will, and it's really something that is the responsibility of all of us to lean in, to raise awareness, to provide tools and resources, to up-level conversations we have around, you know, I mean, in construction, we're pretty much, hey, what's my job require me to get it done at any cost? Well, we now see what the outcome of that is. So I think it's important that we partner together to really have a unified voice around why mental health awareness is important, why it matters, and how we can frankly do better as an industry. It takes each of us leaning in to really create that.
All right, we're back. So Jackson, tell us a little bit about your journey into this that drove you to, you know, where you are today.
So I'll give you a little bit of backstory about my career in the business. So about 25 years ago, my dad started a business in our garage restoring windows in you know, really his properties, our house, neighbors' houses, formed a group of neighbors that would get together, fix up each other's houses. And growing up around it, I was like, oh, skilled trade. I was like, I wanted to get into music production. I wanted to get into, you know, the cool stuff that, you know, 15-year-olds wanted to do at the time, not realizing the wonderful journey that was ahead of me in construction. So started in the garage. We went to a small shop with like 10 people, mostly like local neighbors, kind of basically family. And then here we are 25 years later. We got 44 employees and we're one of the national leaders in our niche of historic window restoration. So I went out on my journey about 10 years ago to get a degree in construction management. Decided that I needed to come over. I had the opportunity to take over the family business and really help grow it. So we were really intentional about going out and learning. I worked as a superintendent, assistant superintendent for two top E&R firms, built a lot of stuff on the ground. That led me to DPR Construction. I worked with them for a while and really got into the construction tech there. Was able to work with their innovation team and really just see what's possible, get on the leading edge there. And during COVID, my dad called and said, "Hey, now's the time to come back. You know, I need your help. If you're going to come take over, I need you." And so I just topped out my first, mid-rise structure, first tower crane, first concrete structure that had been a dream of mine. About 2 months after that's when he called. And I was like, well, I think the timing's right. And so I went from working for a multi-billion dollar company to our business, which was doing about a little over $2 million in revenue at the time. And it was a very small family business. And I had not, I had not come up in that, or it had been about 10 years since I'd had that experience. And I was a completely different person at that time, and had been using technology, using management systems, using project management software, really just on the leading edge. I'm coming back into a preservation business, and we had been preserving a lot of the same business systems as well, just doing things by paper, just really on hair on fire, responding to the market, and really just being a typical small family business. Successful, had a lot of great stuff, but my goal was to transform it into a leader both in our niche nationally, but also try to use my position as a small business owner to leverage technology and set an example. And that's what about 4 months in, 3 months in, somebody, a friend introduced us to Energy. It was like, "Hey man, got this great software. You guys should look at it." And we looked at it and like, I talked to my dad about it. He's like, "Oh no." I was like, that's too complex for us. We need something simple." I was like, "No dad, this is what we need." And so I called up Mark. And the introductory call, I was like, "Hey, I can transform my business with this. I see it. I see the vision. This is going to help me bring continuous improvement. This is going to give me the data I need." I was like, "I got to get my dad on board with this. We got to figure out how to get us on." And I think probably 2 weeks after that call, we were signed up. So that was about 2.5 years ago. When we started our journey with Energy. And I'll give you a high level spoiler. At the time, we were engineered to be a break even business, and 2.5 years later, we're turning our first significant profits, and really have stabilized our business. And I think Energy is one of the one, if not the most pivotal tool to helping us get there. And I think that the other businesses that use it as well would have similar stories about their ability to transform using their data. It's been phenomenal. So speaking from it, from experience, and that's why I wanted to connect Mark with the contact crew, connect Energy with this Nexus, the CPC, and really the innovators that I've been familiar with. I found it really odd that actually Mark wasn't familiar with some of this network, because he is, in my opinion, just a wonderful innovator. And so really, really love the opportunity to kind of bring him into the circle and, have him talk a little bit about what they're doing in the future.
Well, so you brought him here. You just put him on a pedestal. So Mark,
sorry, Mark,
but it is amazing. And I got my start in ERPs. So like ERP systems are core to what I do and who I am. And I understand them, and they're heavily overlooked. And honestly, because in our business, most of them are dinosaurs at best, because the process hasn't really changed. So yeah. I'm interested, Mark, you're not even like Jackson had to fight you to get to get it, because it's not who you built it for. So what did you build, and why did you build this? Like, why would you come after this group, especially given, tell me who your actual like primary user group is and your primary problem case.
Yeah. So Jeff, let me give you a little bit of background towards that end and hopefully answer the question that you're, so, you know, the classic question of why. So back in 1997, I bought a woodworking shop in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And at that point in time, we had four computers, and one did not happen to be on the owner's desk. And so the whole premise, the thesis that we had at that point in time was, it's not necessarily about the sawdust and the back end. It's about the ones and zeros. It's about the information management, which is the classic aspect of what construction's about. It's the ones and zeros. It's the issue. It's the information flow all the way through. So we kind of had that as a premise when we purchased the company back in 97. And we looked for software, some tools to help us move and achieve that vision, if you will, in terms of tech. It wasn't out there. And so what we decided to do is literally we hired our own developer, and we've been at Wilkie. We've literally been writing our own software since about 2000. And so as that software developed, the and solving problems throughout the process of construction with specifically the woodworking trade, we got to the point that we were doing some benchmarking tours, and people were coming in and seeing what we had. And they said, whoa, wait a minute. Could we buy this? I'm like, no, it's on FileMaker Pro. It's in an old technology. Yes, it's a relational database, but just like a farmhouse, you know, that farmhouses, every time you have an extra set of twins or you have another kid, you're adding onto that farmhouse. It looks ugly. It's clunky. But man, does it work and produce profits at the end of the day? And so we finally got to the point that we decided, okay, there's enough demand out there. There's enough interest. The construction industry in and of itself is getting to the point of maturation with tech. I would argue that construction in general is a little bit behind, let's say, the auto industry from which I came and the application of technology, whether that's AI or just data flow in general. We are behind. Now, that curve is starting to change, which is phenomenal. But we had enough people coming in and saying, hey, what about your software? And we finally made the commitment about 5 years ago. We're going to take this software, put it into a current architecture for the web, SaaS-based, cloud-based, the whole nine yards, and start selling it. Woodworking, the woodworking industry, that architectural woodworking, which we've already heard Jackson say that he's on the fringe of, and that's perfect. But that was our starting point. That was the basis of our design. That was our learning model, if you will. And so from that, we started going to market till about 3.5-4 years ago with our product, and it's been very successful ever since. At least that was your first kind of the story to your first question, Jeff. I'll let you get a follow-up or, yeah, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen this before, right? We've seen a couple of groups do this. You gave me a little bit of a flashback when you said FileMaker Pro. I can't tell you how many in my IT days, how many FileMaker Pro softwares I came across that they were like, no, it's the greatest thing. And I'm like, no, it's a ticking time bomb. Like, run away. We don't really, well, and when it's, you had the, at least, you know, the wherewithal to say like, no, we're not selling you this one. You know, we can use this one. Cause like it's, you know, I used to run a POS system, and it was like, yeah, it's a POS, but it's our POS, right? It's ours. We're allowed to do that internally, but you know, as a commercial product, it wouldn't be good. A lot of groups can't make that commercial jump because they end up running into problems where their own workflows, their own, you know, experiences don't really apply. So it's unique to see how you got that. And I wonder, were there bumps, or, you know, was it so specific in the trade that you went after to just modernize it that it helped you go to market with it?
Yeah, Jeff, that is absolutely a perfect insight in terms of that evolution and the growth of our software. So I'm gonna give you another story. I'm full of stories. So when we were back in 97, 98, looking for a piece of software, there was a company in Canada that kind of did the exact same thing that we did, but here was the software. We were their first beta test example here in the States. But here was the thing that we ended up learning. It was their way or no way. No flexibility in terms of the design, no customization, no general principles upon which the software was constructed. And I'll just give you a general principle example, theory of constraints. So if you're a huge fan of the book, The Goal, or Eli Goldthwait and the theory of constraints, and how that applies to our industry and what we do to ourselves in construction with these constantly shifting bottlenecks, that is one of the foundational elements, as opposed to the process must be X. And so that learning back in the early 2000s, late 90s, relative to this product from Canada, was like, we can never do that. We need to make sure that our architecture is flexible, and we're providing that flexibility with a foundation based on theory, based on philosophy, based on these very good practices like theory of constraints, bottleneck reports, job costing, ease of data flow, etc. But on top of that customization, the businesses like Jackson's and others, without that, you're not going to find that balance and get up that acceptance curve. Because at the end of the day, people are the constraint. They're the ones that have to change the process. And if you don't allow that flexibility to the way that we do it, and allow that semi-customization to your workflows, you're not going to be successful on a broad basis.
I did not know that it was the theory of constraints. It's funny. We've been saying it, and I've been saying it for a long time. Like, configurable and customizable is the analogy I use is like, it's like going bowling with no bumpers with my daughter. Neither of us is leaving happy unless I over ordered at the bar. But I'm going to give you the whole lane, honey, but I'm going to put the bumpers up. So you're going to hit pins and you're going to get wins and you're going to keep going. So I love the theory. I like that. And I'm going to have to learn a little bit more about the theory of constraints, because it had to not only lead you to, you know, market adoption and some wins now, but it's what I think allowed Jackson to apply this, because this to me was the reason for the story. I sat down with you, Jackson, during COVID, after a CPC call, and you showed me Energy. And tell me a little bit about, because Mark nailed it, that, you know, it's data flow, it's understanding and being able to visualize those things and then use it. So what did it do for your business at Double Hung? By the way, Jackson totally undersold what he does. Just go to any bar in any city or any place in any city that's like classic and look at the windows, and he will talk to you and tell you things you had no idea. And it's freaking awesome, like what Double Hung does. So just a side note that, but how did you grow and apply it? And what were the problems that you saw that Mark and Energy were able to help you as a business owner move this family business forward?
There were a lot of problems I saw that I could solve with Energy. And the first one that really excited me was the ability for us to create a product library that basically coded our processes and gave me standardization of our processes that would allow me to take a really high variance product. You know, windows in every building built pre-1940 are all very different. Even in their similarities, like each one of them has a little nuance, a little different, and it's really hard to standardize. And so our bottleneck was, you know, we had tons of customers, but we couldn't get estimates turned around. And if we were getting estimates turned around, they weren't enough. We didn't understand our cost. We were really just kind of shooting from the hip based on what we had done some exercises to check our price, but I didn't have real world data. I didn't have or real time data. And when I saw what Energy allowed us to do and build out this library of our custom products, you know, essentially the theory is engineered to order. So I tell people our product is a restored window opening. I had a coworker at the time that was really good at the craft. She was looking at a different you know, career path. She wanted to get into something with numbers, and I was like, oh, you might be interested in estimating. And so around the same time, that's when we adopted Energy. And I was able, she had never had any experience estimating, put her onto that. And she was able to come in because she had knowledge of building the product or restoring the product. She knew it. And she was able to then come into Energy and start coding the products and build out our libraries. And to me, that ease of use of taking somebody who had zero experience and being able to take, you know, our product and create standardization was one of the big driving factors. And so that was what I saw when I first got to Double Home before I got to Energy, like I was looking at a way to create takt time. I wanted to create flow. I wanted to really just understand how to turn our process from an artisan. Everybody's just kind of going with the flow. Everybody's, you know, we're responding to the market. We're going to the customers when they want us to. How can I really build a machine that doesn't feel like a factory floor, doesn't feel like a, you know, really just stuffy workplace? Because that was what our culture was, the free flowing artisan feel of, well, we wanted to keep that free flow, but we also, our business health required us to tighten up and get standards and get process. And so the work order management and the production management side of Energy, I saw this ability to create a decentralized command across my different workstations to give our teams the ability to get the information at the right time, ask the right questions, because we were having tons of churn with just, you know, at one point in our business, there would be a line out my dad's door of people just asking questions like, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And, you know, our goal was to empower. Our goal was to like have people take charge, but our information flow was bottlenecking our people's ability to grow and make decisions. And so Energy's production, the production planning aspect of it, it allows us to really just get information to the right people, build up the information in a way that we can really hit production metrics without feeling like we're just out there cracking a whip and just being terrible employers. Don't want to say terrible employers, but I mean, you know, like we don't want that. I don't want people to feel like they're just, you know, getting run into a, you know, a production cycle and not having a say in it or not having fun doing it.
Well, and it ultimately it's a craft, right? And I love that you talked about that with the artisan feel. And we learned this, we were at the SoBuilt event and you brought Don with you. And I thought it was real insightful of him when he was doing some tack workflow stuff and, you know, videoing some process. And it was really cool because he said, oh, I failed you guys as a team. Like, you're going back and forth from that machine 13 times to get the information you need to stay on the machine. I failed you. You need to, I need to provide that information in a way that you can just have it and stay on the machine. That didn't mean like, so ultimately it was like, I just want you to do more of the craft and enjoy it. And doesn't mean being more productive and having more flow. You want to keep the feel of having fun and putting out a killer product, right? That's
I want my people doing what they love, which is working with their hands, putting out great work. I don't want them worrying about what RFI was. I don't want them thinking about all of the stuff that goes to get them to do their best work. I want them to have access to it, but I just saw the frustration and the churn that, you know, my team was experienced when they couldn't get, they were trying to do the best job. They were trying to do the right job. Rework was occurring because information wasn't there. And, you know, I saw that on the job site, you know, tenfold when I was a superintendent. Like, we're out there working 15, 16 hour days. Like, we're getting direction one day, the next day the architect's changing something. We're stopping working. I'm seeing the craft workers in the field, just like really that frustration that causes, this lack of information being to where the people who need it most, like, or getting it right, then getting it wrong, then getting it right, that causes serious issues with the health of our workers. Like, and I don't think that we talk about that enough, that information is not just tied to profitability and flow and process. It's tied to health and getting people to do their best work, helping them do what they love and not deal with all the bull crap. Okay. Sorry. Sometimes I'll slip out, but you know, how much time we spend dealing with just non-value add stuff and how much it hurts us when we're trying to do good work is incredible. I think there's a statistic out there that points at is, you know, 41%. I think when we're in Austin, 41% of every dollar spent in our industry is known waste.
It's waste.
I think it can go as high. Yeah. It's like high as 70-80%. It's like, that's crazy.
Oh yeah. I mean, and that's wasted time, wasted effort, and it does have all of those impacts. And what I think is interesting that you hit on a couple of things. First of all, leaning into an employee that's looking for a career pivot and providing that pivot. Gosh, there's so many leaders in this business afraid of that. Like, you know, the opportunity could have happened that you lost that person, but you took the risk and said, I'm going to take a risk. And I think in the end, you and the business won.
Oh, absolutely.
But to bring it to Mark for a second, a couple things you hit are super hard to achieve in a technology, but super key to that technology's success. Taking something super hard and complex and making it easy to use and easy to understand, that takes a lot of work. And then, you know, you've said it, you're talking about codifying the information. That line at your dad's door, that was all in his head. That's all in the back heads of the people, you know, that have the experience that are sitting in those offices. So codifying it, getting it into the system just empowers them, but it also allows you, as you continue to grow your company, to do that. And I think that's the data flow of information that Mark's trying to achieve inside of the software to ultimately take you guys from reactive to proactive, right? To this beautiful flow state. So Mark, I'm interested, like, when you hear Jackson talk about that, that's got to hit at a couple of key points that you at Energy and the team is trying to do and trying to make sure you have in your software.
Yeah, I'm humbled by what Jackson described, and I'm really excited about the change that's happened in his organization. And let's just spend a moment on that experience curve or codifying our workflows within the software. So think a little bit about construction in the past, or trade partners, or any business for the most part. We have a choice as we're making hiring decisions and process decisions. And I'm going to go back to the early 2000s, if you will, so it's far enough away that I'm not criticizing anybody. But much of our work in the construction industry was about hiring the right person that had experience. And if you could see me, it's about the gray hair. You hire that maverick that understands, and what they're going to do internally is say, hey, I remember on this job I had this problem, therefore I'm going to make sure that that problem doesn't raise its ugly head in our workflow again. And so construction is all about problem solution. And so what we did as an industry is we found people that had lived through that cycle, and that's what we did. That's what we hired. That's what we looked for. That's what we pined for. But that's not going to be the case going forward. And so to Jackson's point, how do we codify and put that information, that experience, in the workflow, getting the right info to the right person at the right time? So the education, our tribal stories, our learning that we've had over the years can exist in the system. And so let me just give you a couple examples to what Jackson was talking about. So as Jackson and Double Hung go through their workflow, they have these checklists. And so as they exit a step or a stage, they can put, this stage needs to have these seven things done. Now, some of those can be required, some of those can be nice to have, or some of those might be contextual to whether or not the product flowing through is complex or whatever the case may be. And so putting that learning into the system so that it pops back up right at the right moment for somebody to go, oh yeah, that's right, we had a problem on this before, let me make sure that I don't send that problem downstream. And so looking at that experience, that education, that checklist, and putting it into the software or into the process, let's just put it at that level for now, I'm not trying to sell the software, put it at that level is very fundamental to getting the friction out of the process in the construction industry.
At the Contech Crew, we focus on technology that solves industry problems, and we've always believed in our sponsors. So much so that I went to work for one of them. So today, I want to talk to you about Join. Every construction project is a unique prototype, and it's actually shaped by thousands of decisions that impact the owner's business case, design, and the budget. Today, the communication driving these decisions is disjointed across all the stakeholders. Work happens in email, Excel, estimating, resulting in delays, waiting for decisions, waiting for access to information, and sometimes that information is outdated and incomplete. Managing the expectations of the team and keeping the project moving forward is a constant challenge, and a lot of times drives skepticism amongst the contributors. Join Empower's general contractors to build with confidence and maximize the potential of every project by connecting these owners through new workflows that fit into your existing processes. We bring design teams and trade partners into a single platform. There's transparency and collaboration in the decision making, which builds trust and sets projects up for success. You might be asking yourself, do you need another tool? Well, let me tell you, Join fits in seamlessly with your processes and your other tools. In fact, we're here to help those other tools. Regardless of your estimating system or your project management process, Join will be a valuable added resource without disrupting those other systems and your teams. Check out Join, the collaborative project delivery platform for the built environment. Learn more at join.build. It's got to be there. Like, you're not even selling the software. You're really selling the idea that we've got to get that there. That's real time. So often when we talk real time, and Jackson will know this one, like, we go to some sort of like magical, wonderful world that's going to tell us about the thing around the corner that's scary that we didn't know was coming. It's like, okay, that would be awesome if we had a software that could predict all the problems that we might experience. But actually, those aren't that's not what's required, right? We have those experienced people. We have leaders that can handle those. It's the little mistakes because of lack of information, because of a lack of a reminder or a process assistant, so to speak, that build up over time, right? It's death by a thousand cuts. I didn't die by one giant one. It's by a thousand little cuts. And so that's why it's important. And it might seem silly that it's a checklist or whatever, but, you know, especially given, Jackson, what you do, like, there's nuances to every one of those products. But
every single one.
And you're doing a historical building, and I think this is awesome because, like, you know, some of this is that historical buildings need to be preserved the way that they are. So a lot of what you guys do at Double Hung is kind of mandated to replace those so that they're modern and efficient, right?
But nope. Restore. We don't replace.
Restore. That's what I mean.
Restore.
See?
Yeah.
That's what
yeah.
I got.
Yep.
You restore them.
Window tangent.
Yeah. That's okay. I get to learn. This is what I love about this because I get to learn everything. You restore these windows in such a way that they are now efficient, but they are back to looking original because they are the original, right? They're just restored.
Yep.
So if you're reinventing the wheel every time, that's tough. So you've got to have this.
Yep. And we, part of our sales strategy is it is a mystic thing, window restoration, because as a society, we've been taught window replacement. You got to replace your windows. You got to go for efficiency. But if you're looking at even the most efficient windows, they're still in, especially in a historic space, they're inefficient holes in the wall, even in their most efficient form. And so we've told our story as we've evolved. We've got the story of telling people why they should restore and how special their windows are, which is true. Old growth pine, hand mouth blown glass, like truly like antiques and like beautifully built windows. And like, as a society, you know, coming out of the 70s, we've been told, nope, rip them out, put in this vinyl, put in this, like, and the efficiency curve has been, you know, in the window games, like, nope, you need a high efficient window. It's like, nope, actually your windows, if you're thinking about sustainability, long-term, you know, carbon impacts, preserving them is the best. But so internally, what that turned into is us telling like how special, and that turned into us then looking at every single window as an artifact and as a very unique thing, which is true, but that makes it really hard to standardize. When you're looking at every product that comes through, you're looking at everything needs a special process. And you're like, so trying to find that balance of, yes, every window is different. It is unique. It is special to the building. It was built specifically for that building. But that doesn't mean if we look at everything as unique and has to have its own process, it makes for really hard to manage. And so that's where we want to tell people, you know, as sales strategy, as a just client education strategy, just as an industry education strategy, yes, they are very special and unique, high variance, but when we're managing it, we want to get it down to simple process. We want to get, you know, we're the experts. We know all the things that need to happen with it. Let's codify it. And guru, my dad, the window expert, learned all this stuff. And Mark, we learned this term from Mark. We say now IDH in dad's head. So like, how do we get that knowledge, that 20, 30 year knowledge out of dad's head? How do we get it so we can train the next generation of craft workers? And so my mini mission with Double Hung is, okay, if I can transfer knowledge from my dad's head and bring it into a software where I can leverage data to preserve all those lessons learned, that can be done with any business. That can be done with plumbers, electricians, because, you know, 2030 is approaching. We're losing, 40 to 60% of our craft workers. And a lot of the craft workers are now running businesses. And, you know, as you run a business, you're like, man, I don't get to do what I love. I don't get to teach the people what I know. I have to just really focus on cash flow and get money in to get paychecks. I can't go out there and train people when I've got, you know, accounts receivable, you know, 90 days out. And so we've really, as an industry, and I know I talked about this at the CPC, through our contracting, we've made it really, really hard for subcontractors to pass on that knowledge, because they've become, instead of craft work professionals teaching other craft work professionals, building up the craft work network and apprentices, they're risk managers now. They're contract managers. They're out there, figuring out how to go to the bank. And, you know, that's not where, if we're going to get through this labor shortage, like, we need the people who know the knowledge passing on the knowledge, and we need the people who can manage the contracts and the information helping us to do it better from the craft work level. And I think that, to plug in energy to this, energy gives us that tool to fight back against the surge of unfair contract regulations, unfair, contract language and bad schedules. It gives us as a trade partner real good data to protect ourselves and keep our consistency, so we can focus on doing the better things, or the more fun things and the more necessary things, like teaching our people how to do the work instead of how to manage ourselves from bad protect ourselves from bad contracts.
I mean, you hit a couple of things there. I love in dad's head. I'm going to steal that IDH. It's in dad's head. We got to get it out. Yeah. Funny, I was doing some prep work to go to the Northwest Wall and Ceiling Bureau earlier this year and talk. And I was just kind of tapping on wall and ceiling contractors and finding out what their problems were. And it's so interesting that their number one problem, Jackson, is with the rising cost of cash flow, of cash itself. They were spending 30 and 40% of their time on that problem and making sure it was right and making sure they were dotting I's and crossing T's and getting paid and doing those things. And it made me go, look, you're working in the business instead of on the business, right? Like, that you've got to be away from that. You've got to make that, you know, those are the things that, you're not a snowflake in that world, right? This is not rocket science, you know. Mark's tool and other tools, lots of tools do this, right? In lots of different industries. Like, that basic part is not different than others. What is different is exactly what you said, the craft and the teaching. So you should be working on growing that business and sharing that knowledge and recruiting those people and moving forward. So super cool to hear you do that. And I'll jump you back. I mean, if you guys don't understand just the value of the materials itself that Jackson's talking about saving, I knew nothing about, you know, historical and old growth, et cetera, until I had the Urban Machine team on here. But they've built this whole thing. If you don't know Urban Machine, Mark, this will blow your mind because you're in the woodworking business. Basically, they realized that we were throwing away and putting all of this fantastic wood into our landfills when we could recondition it. But the problem was, it's super inefficient for a human to try to recondition a piece of wood. Pulling out nails and screws and figuring out, is that a screw or is that a nail? And through robotic technology and computer vision and some other things, they built a machine that, as you're pulling this historical wood out, you can throw it through it and it'll recondition it. So it's an awesome machine and super sustainable. And like, I didn't understand that what you're talking about, Jackson, and that old growth wood around that window, we can't just go get that. It's just not possible.
Yeah. No.
So I love the push towards reusing that. That was a total tangent and a push to my friends at Urban Machine, because I absolutely love that thing. Like, I keep seeing them and I love it. And I think it goes to, like, staying to the craft of what we do. The interesting part is, you know, to bring it back over to Mark is, you know, Mark, you're listening to him and I saw you nodding your head like, yes, yes, Jackson, that's what we're here to do. We're here to give you that. We're here to give you those things. We're here to let you do that. So talk a little bit about, I mean, obviously coming from your own company and using it, like, you've drank your own Kool-Aid along the way, right? So eating your own dog food. I got to stop using the drink your own Kool-Aid. That did not end well. So eating your own dog food, even though it even sounds a little less appetizing, is probably a better analogy. So you ate your own dog food and then you wanted to provide that out to help other companies to fuel them. So talk a little bit about, you know, kind of how you've seen the problems that Jackson and others are experiencing and then how you go about solving it.
Yeah, that's the great question. And one of Jackson's point was thinking a little bit about custom products in the construction industry. In order to standardize and grow, you got to standardize on something. Growth requires some semblance of standardization. And so what Jackson was saying a little bit earlier is that standardization is not on the product, but it's on the process. And within the software, that process standardization, whether it's a window type A or window type B, it is going through the exact same workflow and the same learning. But that standardization ends up now having a foundation for our clients to understand and grow. And if you just standardize, that's not enough. You just can't, okay, now you can standardize in your process. The key here, I would argue, when you think about SaaS implementations, success rate with SaaS ERP implementations, more specifically, is somewhere between 30 and 40%. Most fail. And so the issue in that failure, I've done some examples and said, you know, people ask me, so how long does it take to get implemented in this? And I've heard people kind of chat with me about that. And I said, okay, let me give you a story. I got a 60-person firm in the ETO industry that's, they got up to speed in about 90 days, 0 to 90. I got another firm, it's about the exact same size. They've still been doing it for 3 years. And what I did was I gave the great software to the 60-day firm, the 90-day firm, and I gave the really crappy software to the one that's still working on it 3 years later. And people typically laugh at that point in time, and they recognize the variable of control, the one that you want to pull and lever, is the change management within the organization. So to your question, Jeff, is how do we make sure that these nods, this conversation, this response that you saw me having with Jackson, it's about the education. So yeah, the tool is there. It's like a table saw or a CNC that's in the shop or a belt sander or a backhoe. It's just a tool. Without it being integrated to the business process, what we're doing, without having education in place to help that tool be highly productive, I think ERP systems end up falling short. And so one of the things that we end up doing is putting that software and education together. We have a learning management system that we bring to bear. We have that learning management system. Jackson can absolutely customize it for all his people. And so think about the whole onboarding process and going to Energy University, not only for learning the software and the workflow and the SOPs within his organization that are now documented, but even to the onboarding otherwise. So if there's a certain way that paint needs to be removed on some of these restored windows, he can easily take a video, pop that into our system, our learning management system, and now he has that forever. And so this friction that happens with getting people into our organizations that are successful on day one or really productive on week 3 and 4, we're trying to take that friction away, and we spend a lot of time on the educational component of our value proposition, Jeff.
So powerful, because I've been preaching time to value, time to value, time to value. It is one of the biggest problems with most implementations is the time to value is too long. And that is usually because, look, you bought the software, Jackson, because it's going to change your business, not because you wanted to add users and load data. That's the boring part. Let's get to the usable part. And man, I love mixing it together with a learning management system, Mark. That's a powerful business case for it. And ultimately, you know, looking for that frictionless onboarding is obviously the wave of the future, and SaaS allows us to do that. Like, I mean, that's one of those beautiful things, right? That switching over to that allows us to do. But man, so many people are afraid to say change management. And if I had to pick currently the number one problem in construction technology adoption and applying it, it's change management. And there's a little bit of mea culpa on both sides, right? We've been selling the panacea, going from roadshow to roadshow and selling our elixirs and saying it'll solve your problems. And none of us really wanted to say, but it's going to take a little elbow grease, and you're going to have to get a little rough in there, and it's going to be a little rough and tumble along the way. And you're going to have to be flexible, and you're going to have to manage change. Like, sorry guys, we've been trying to get you. And then on the other side, you know, there's this search for the tool that's going to solve our problems. And I've said this from the stage over and over. If that tool existed, sorry, Mark, I really like you, and Jackson, I really like you, but we wouldn't be having this conversation here. I'd just have a group of people in front of you, and I'd say the answer will be here in just a second. Just pay me my money. I'll give you the answer and I'll go. And that's just not, it's just not how it is. There isn't one out there, and there's not one. Like, there's no one ring to rule them all. What Jackson's using and chose might not work for another one. And Mark, what you've built will work for a bunch of people, but not for others. So I love that. And it's just so scary, man. How, before I jump to you, Jackson, because I'm going to start wrapping us up a little bit, but I do want to hear, how do you approach, Mark, change management for new customers that are coming to you? How do you get them to understand that success rate is honestly based on them? Because I love your anecdote. I'm using that. Like, oh, well, when I get Jackson, I sell him the good stuff. When I get you, I sell you the crappy stuff and you fail.
Yeah.
No, by the way, if you're listening in and you're wondering, it's the same software.
And again, so the variable on that is how the software implementation is managed. And so I'm going to answer your question by going back to another point that you made, Jeff. There is no silver bullet. Hard problems require multiple independent approaches in order to solve. So I think about problems as a balloon, and I use this analogy to try and get people to understand the concept of an integrated set of activities. And I will answer your question directly about what we do, but let me first do the concept. And so if the problem is the balloon and you have to pop it, one finger is not going to pop it. It's just going to move the problem around. And so that's exactly what you said, Jeff, that one silver bullet's not going to solve the problem. It never does. Two fingers kind of poking at the balloon may contain the problem, but it's not going to pop the balloon. You need multiple fingers popping or poking at that balloon to be successful. And so with that kind of as the construct or the rubric for us to think about, now I'm going to answer your question about what we do at Energy in order to make sure that implementation and change management is successful. So one, in terms of our proposal and pricing, we actually are analyzing our clients and giving them back behavior incentives. We call them ABCs, activity-based credits. And so we look at the weaknesses and the strengths of our clients coming in, and we say, you know, we know that success, if you do these seven things, and we've gone back into our data and said, successful companies do these seven things. And so we're going to grade each and every one of our clients on those seven and say, all right, they're probably weak on these two. Let's give them an incentive, financial incentive, to come with us. And if you do these things, that's going to strengthen that muscle, strengthen that weakness in your organization, we will give you money back. And so now we're connecting behavior, the success of our clients, to the success of us. That's just one aspect of what we end up doing. And so another is our whole educational offering, it's free. You're part of the Energy family. We are not going to put friction in place for education, because that education is the foundation, is the grist, if you will, in the mill of learning and change. In addition to that, we have an all-you-can-eat buffet. Well, that's what we refer to it as. And so there are some organizations that sell our ERP and say, here's your software. Oh, by the way, if you want some additional training or help, it's $250 an hour. We don't do that because that ends up being a constraint to people learning and changing in the organization. It's like, it's one price, it's free. You want to go back to that buffet a couple more times? Not a problem. We want to make sure you're successful. In addition to that, and I'll pause here, but we have more fingers than what I'm just describing popping up at Loon. And this is the whole concept of that integrated set of activities. I'll give you the last one. We give an unconditional guarantee in terms of the down payment refund. In the first 12 months, if we're not successful with you, we'll give you your money back. And so that puts us engaged and connects us with our clients to make sure that their success is our success and vice versa. And so we're putting our money where our mouth is. I love the phrase about eating the dog food. I use it all the time. And so that set of integrated activities of evaluation, our activity-based credits, money-back guarantee, our educational and our LMS system together, coupled with and so on, puts a series of activities where we're reaching into our client and helping them change through that 3 to 4 month process of getting up to speed.
Jackson, I know why you brought Mark to me. There's so many things that I just want to violently agree with you on. I cannot tell you how angry it makes me when somebody's like, I'm going to sell you my software and then I'm going to charge you to train on it.
That's BS.
Isn't your success my success? Like, man. No, that's not how this works. And a money back guarantee that, I mean, especially when you said most implementations of ERP systems are 30 to 40% likely to fail. Like, and I've done them for years and that number's pretty close. I can believe it. So it's in this industry in particular, but in all industries, I'm looking for a partner, not for a vendor. And we are a relationship-based business, and this is how we do business with our general contractors as trade partners. It's how we do it with our owners. Why shouldn't it be that way with our software companies? And why should it matter if I'm, you know, it's all here. You can eat it all, and you can have it as many times as you want. We know that works. And man, is it that... All right. If you guys are listening in, you got to go check these guys out because I absolutely know why Jackson brought Mark to us. I'm going to be excited to just watch what Energy has next. Yep. And that philosophy and grading your customers, it's hard to know where we suck. But if you don't know where you suck, you can improve. and somebody has to tell us nicely. I'm sure you don't tell them that they suck. You say, hey, there's some room for improvement against your customers. But look, man, like how many times you blow, if the vendor blows smoke up, Jackson, you almost got me doing it. Then I'm just going to think I'm great and everything's going to be great. And it's like, no, you're here for a reason in the first place. And we can all learn. And you, Mark, have a purview that most other people don't have of a swath of people using the software, using the product and being successful or not successful. So why would I not want to take your feedback on my business from your perspective? You're not saying, hey, you're restoring Windows wrong. You're saying, hey, listen, we know that successful companies with new ERP systems do these things well, and we think you're doing 4 out of 7 well. There's 3 areas for improvement. And then now you've given me a reason to get a discount to go do that. That's awesome. I love it. Yeah, you guys got to go check out Energy. I'm going to be watching them a little bit more closely. Jackson, I wanted to leave you last because, you know, I have been thoroughly impressed with you coming over into taking over and, you know, holding true to what your dad and the organization was built off of it at Double Hung, but thoughtfully then bringing it into the next evolution because you're leading other people. I mean, we talked about this at the So Built that, you know, this is a churn and burn and we have no room to turn and burn anymore. And if there's other folks out there listening, you're not a billion-dollar contractor. You know, you're the salt of the earth, but you've turned this from a even Steven to you guys are turning a profit. What advice can other people listening in that are in that space, you know, learn from you? And what advice would you give them right now?
Well, I think everything that I do and what motivates me to drive change is one statistic, right? And I know we've talked about this, the suicide rate in construction, right? So if we do not change, not only are we losing lives, if we don't put people first, make it a more equitable environment for the craft workers, the people who are actually doing the backbreaking work in many cases, if we don't create a better life for them, both on the job site and outside of the job site, none of us have a future, right? So, you know, we are at that inflection point as a society. And I think really, you know, being coming from the field, coming from the job sites, now coming to the executive seat and really looking at where people are and how tough it is out there for everybody in our industry, especially the craft workers, the ones that are out there traveling, going to the job site, you know, do it for them, right? Because if we don't have and we don't make radical change in this industry and we don't make it a better life for the people who are out there putting their physical and mental on the line every day, we won't have office jobs. We won't have construction tech. We won't have a built environment. And so, you know, everything that motivates me is, you know, it's unacceptable the rate that we're at every, you know, I think it's 51.4 out of 100,000 construction workers commit suicide, and we don't talk about it. We don't actively have an integrated set of activities popping that balloon. But look at construction safety, 3.4 out of 100,000 die in construction related incidents. That's still too high, but it's much lower. Where was it in the 70s before the OSHA Act? I don't know, but we've got to be having an integrated set of activities that puts our craft workers first, makes it a more equitable environment for them. And when we're looking at the amount of waste that's in the industry, you're not going to save it by funneling profits back to the owners or back upstream. We got to funnel it down to the people who need it most. And that's how we're going to solve the profitability crisis in construction and the suicide problem in construction, at least in my opinion.
Man, I told you guys, this is why I brought Jackson on, because it's that mentality, right? That it started with, and his first talk was about the suicide rate in this industry, which unfortunately we are now the top industry. And that is not a statistic we wanted to win. And we're not just the top in the United States. We're the top in the United Kingdom. And we are the top in Australia and New Zealand. So that is not a triple crown we wanted. And we have to focus on changing that experience. And you're right. We've got to funnel those profits down, and those profits have been going in the wrong direction. But it's because we need to take on modern leadership. And that's what we needed, Jackson. We need people like you to lead. We need lots of, Mark, to yours, fingers popping the balloon. We have Get Construction Talking, you know, which is going after all three of those areas. We have Prevent Construction Suicide. We have lots of mental health resources going out there. But ultimately, it's not going to change if the owners of the businesses, the leaders of the trades, the leaders of the people that do the work in our business don't make a change. So, and quite frankly, the ones who are making the change like you are going to be profitable, and you're going to win. And that's another, that's a hell of a way to win. And I'm not going to cut that one out. So, with that, I want to thank both you guys for sitting down with me today. This has been an awesome episode. Jackson, you know, I can't wait to see you again out there on the road. Mark, it was awesome to meet you. You guys have been great. You know, just thanks so much, Mark, for stopping in and just giving so many great stories and so many great analogies for the folks listening in.
You're more than welcome, Jeff. It was my honor, my privilege.
And Jackson, you're going to be a regular, man. I want to hear more about what you're doing, and just keep up the great work out there, man. It's been great to get to know you and to watch the growth of Double Hung.
Likewise, I appreciate being on. It's you know, it's an honor to be shared in this company. So I appreciate both of you and your perspectives and what y'all are doing to push the industry forward. So love it.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Jackson Hoggard and Mark Sanderson. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is the Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.